Welcome to Fanboy News Network, your guide to geek culture. I'm your host, Jeff Harris, and this is part two of our look at the hidden gems of horror. And once again, we're joined by Jennifer Lovely of Hello. Jenga Loves, where she writes about movies she loves, mostly horror. And we're at her house. She's our lovely hostess for the day. And Michael Montour, who is our friend who also writes horror novels. Mm-hmm. So last time we had ended on talking about Asian horror films when we really ran out of time. Was there anything else either of you want to talk about Asian horror before we move on to any other subjects?
Really, really briefly mentioned A Tale of Two Sisters, okay. Which I really love, which is actually out of Korea, South Korea. And you really casually mentioned too, but I think it really deserves a push, is also Dark Water.
Yeah, Dark Water is pretty fantastic.
Really wonderful. Looking through my list, I think that's kind of it in the Asian. Are we going to touch on foreign?
Sure. Let's move on to foreign.
I feel like I'm not talking about them at all, but just mentioning Devil's Backbone, which is Guillermo del Toro, which is just a wonderful, frightening ghost movie that takes place in Spain during the Spanish, is it Civil War?
Yeah, I believe so.
Or just after. And it is a terrifying ghost story. And I don't know. I mean, what other, it kind of takes place in an orphanage, and it's just very Guillermo.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. Guillermo's earlier, smaller horror films have been so eclipsed by the bigger things he's done since. I think once he did Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah.
A lot of people forgot that he had Kronos some really... Kronos is another
Devil's
one.
Backbone.
Have you seen Kronos?
I have. I own Kronos.
Wow. Practically everyone I talk to about Kronos is like, what? He made that? What?
Yeah. That might be worth looking at again sometime.
Yeah.
Just for the nostalgia factor.
I haven't seen it since it was in the theaters, and that was in the Mesozoic era, I believe.
It was certainly an interesting take on the vampire genre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love interesting takes on vampires and so.
So let's, what else in the foreign genre was, do you think was, obviously you have Suspiria, which is a great horror film that a lot of people haven't seen. I always enjoyed Suspiria. It's a very slow movie.
There's a couple movies that I own just because I think they're important in the grand scheme of horror, but I don't particularly enjoy them that much. Mm-hmm. And Suspiria is one of those. The only other one that I want to take is also Spanish, is Thesis, or Thesis.
Yeah, I want to see
it's,
that.
It's Alejandro Amenábar, is that? Probably butchering his name.
Think that's right?
He is the director who did The Others, with Nicole Kidman, and did Open Your Eyes. I'm fairly certain he did both the American version and the Spanish version that had Penelope Cruz. I think both of them actually had Penelope Cruz. It's really interesting because it is a take on how much violence there is in horror and how we pay attention to violence. It is a woman writing a thesis paper on violence in the media, and she starts trying to seek out the most violent films she can, and she ends up finding a snuff film, and finding out that there are a group of people who are kidnapping people and killing them in the snuff film, and in snuff films that they're putting out. And it struck me. And I have only seen it, as soon as I watched it, I used to do a Chicks and Flicks night where I had a bunch of women I got together with, and we all picked a movie, and they would pick really wonderful things, and I'd pick Spanish horror movies. I watched it that first time.
Because you're the weird friend.
I'm the weird friend. Yay!
Which is why you hang out with us.
Exactly, yeah.
But I watched it then, and I watched it, so this is probably 13 years ago now. It's 1996 it originally came out. It's one of those movies where I think original watchings, even if they don't stand to later watchings, I think original watchings having a high impact is worthwhile and important. Mm. And sometimes we were just talking recently that you rewatched Children of the Corn, you're like, why did I love that?
Yeah.
I think that important first watching, and I think Thesis does stand up to rewatching, but mainly I hold it up in this esteem from that time, 13 years ago when I watched it, and it just blew my mind.
Well, I on the original watching, I think the other thing is some films just don't hold up over time.
Yeah.
You know, we get more sophisticated in our tastes, you know, things change.
But are they any less important? Yeah,
I there are times where it's like, well, this was really important in its era, but it just doesn't hold up because we've become so much more used to other things. The tropes have become so well-worn that they don't bother us. It's like, you know, watching, I actually tried doing this when I watched Frankenstein.
The original?
About a year and a half ago, when I wanted to review it for the site.
The original?
The original, okay. the 1931 Frankenstein.
I think it holds up really well.
Holds up well, but what I was trying to do was trying to put myself in the mindset of, I've never seen a film like this before. I did not grow up with Herman Munster. That what did that first reveal of the monster do to an audience that wasn't used to something like that, where we didn't have the history of Jack Jack Palance, and it's not it. I want to say it's Jack Pierce. Anyway, it's this famous makeup artist.
Oh, yes.
Who did a lot of the Universal monsters, and he created the Frankenstein look, and he created the Wolfman. And he's Rick Baker's inspiration. What was it like in the 30s watching these films when we didn't have the tropes that they themselves created?
I wish sometimes watching certain movies there was a button you could hit. I felt the same way the first time I watched Casablanca, where I was like, I wish it weren't pop culture because it's so good.
Yeah.
With Frankenstein. Imagine watching that with fresh eyes.
Although that does bring in another gem I was thinking about. You were talking about foreign films that I want to talk about. And I've actually reviewed this on the site before, but it's worth mentioning. And that was in the 30s, when talking films were still a very new thing. The idea of overdubbing a film wasn't something they were used to or putting in subtitles. So if they wanted to sell one of their films to a foreign market, what they did was, they completely remade the film with a cast that spoke the language. And sadly, because these were secondaries to the studios, very few of them were preserved. But fortunately, one of the very few that's preserved in its entirety is the Spanish language Dracula they made at the same time as the Lugosi film. And it's fascinating
to watch.
And on
the same sets, if I remember right.
Same set, same shooting script, just translated to Spanish. Yeah. They had a different director who's, unfortunately, I didn't get my research. I know Todd Browning did the original Dracula. And as Jen is looking to see if she can find it for me, I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but the director of the Spanish version was the director of Rudolph Valentino's The Sheik.
Oh, okay.
So he was an established Hollywood director. And it's fascinating to watch if you've never got a chance, because he actually had a sense of competition with Browning. He actually was a little offended he didn't get to do the English language version.
Hmm.
So because of the nature of what they did, he got to watch the dailies of Browning's shoot. And he went, you know what? I can do better.
Nice.
And a lot of people who have seen the Spanish version consider it overall superior to Browning's, because the other director had a better sense of pacing for sound films. Browning paced
and
Dracula like a silent film.
I am going to draw some fire here, but I probably had a better actor. I don't think Bela Lugosi was a very good actor. I know.
Well, here's the thing.
I'm goth, and I...
I don't disagree with you. I think that Spanish actor was a great actor.
Yeah.
The difference was he didn't have the innate charisma that Lugosi did. Lugosi was iconic.
Yeah.
This other guy was good.
Yeah.
But he didn't have that iconic allure that Lugosi brought. And that's, it can be different. It's the way somebody with little talent can become a star, although I don't think Lugosi had little talent. I just think that he got overshown a lot by other actors.
Yeah.
This is a big sidebar, but I'll do it. This is why he had a bit of a rivalry with Boris Karloff.
Who is an amazing actor.
And I think there was always that, I should be a bigger star. Yeah, I think he was jealous, and that's... We could do a whole episode on Boris Karloff, which we might someday. I love the man, and I think talking about the iconic actors would be fun. But right now, we're talking about hidden gem films. So, I just want to bring that up because so few people, even if they've seen the Bela Lugosi Dracula, have not had a chance to see the Spanish version.
You need to do that some Friday, because I've never seen
Spanish.
It.
Yeah, I've got it. So
it what's really fun, we would maybe need extra time, because what's fascinating is to watch them back to back, because then you're doing the comparison, and then you suddenly
see... I think we've all seen it recently enough.
The differences, and the fact that he took two different scenes from the movie that Browning did as two different scenes and intercut them.
Oh.
It improved the pacing amazingly.
Sure.
Okay.
Suddenly two long drawn out scenes suddenly had a lot more at stake because you realize, oh, there's this other thing going on. It's at the same time. Oh, this is going to be interesting. Although I think this also brings, sorry, go ahead.
That would help the main problem that I had with Browning's Dracula is it was adapted from the stage version of Dracula. And you can tell.
Yeah.
It feels like a stage play. But if you're actually intercutting things that are going on at the same time, that would really help get rid of that feeling.
Well, also, I've also heard that the director was really, really, really good friends with Lon Chaney, who he'd originally wanted to play Dracula.
That would have been great.
And don't even get me started on Lon Chaney, and was in just horrific mourning and actually handed off a lot of his direction to other people, assistant directors, and actually didn't put as much work in on it.
I also find it's interesting, just side note, because again, I research everything and when I and I review Dracula, the other actor that almost got it before Lugosi was going to be Conrad Veidt.
I am not familiar with that
name. Conrad Veidt was a horror star. He did The Man Who Laughs and Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Okay.
He was the Somnambulist.
Which I've never seen, and which is so crazy.
So he's also the image that they based the Joker on from The Man Who Laughs. He was General Strasser, or Colonel Strasser in Casablanca.
Okay.
He was the lead. He had visa problems. He had to return to Germany in 31, which is why he didn't get to do Dracula.
Yeah.
I always wonder, considering how, if Veidt had done that, he probably would have been the iconic actor. As it is, he's well remembered by film aficionados. This does bring up an interesting point, though, since we're talking in hidden gems. In a lot of ways, what we're talking about is horror films horror fans should be watching. And I think a lot of modern horror fans don't pay attention to the classics. Mm-hmm. I mean, the old, you know, where the movie tropes came from. You talk to a lot of people, oh, Frankenstein, it's a classic movie. Yeah, have you seen it before?
No. Yeah.
Have you watched Dracula? Have you watched The Wolfman? Or do you just... Here's a bit of trivia for you. What common werewolf movie element never appears once in The Wolfman?
Does it change by the moon? Is he not lunarly driven?
He is not lunarly driven. In fact, the full moon never even is shown. Oh, yeah. You never see the moon in Wolfman because the full moon was a creation to the werewolf myth.
Where's
from
my
the
cookie?
Sequel.
Sorry.
Yeah. But that's it. Yeah, it's the original Wolfman. It's autumn. It's the Wolfbane blooming is causing the transformation.
Right.
And it's only in the following film, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, that they introduce the lunar cycle into the mythos, and that's where everything else gets it. But that's a thing a lot of people don't know because they haven't seen these films.
It's like how the idea of vampires being vulnerable to sunlight comes from Nosferatu. Mm.
Because it was not in the novel.
You haven't seen that? Oh, wow.
I know.
Okay.
I'm going to have my heart taken away.
I mean, if we talk about the hard thing of getting people to watch the old talkie classics, imagine how many people haven't seen The Silence.
I know. I actually have a list of, like, all the Silence that I really want. Like, I really want to see Gollum.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would love to see that, too.
One of the things I was hoping on when I was on my honeymoon back a year and a half ago, and we did a VIP tour of Universal Studios, I know that the Phantom of the Opera set is still standing. And
you
I was
are
hoping
me. Oh
and
my
I was
God.
Hoping, so hoping it was part of the tour. It wasn't.
Yeah.
That's my only disappointment is I would have loved to have seen that set.
I'm actually making an effort right now. I've been doing a lot of research on kind of the movies that kickstarted the genre for certain tropes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them I just bought which was kind of considered one of the first slasher movies was 13 Women. Which was kind of lost for a really long time. It has Myrna Loy playing a half-Asian classmate at a boarding school who is basically gossiped out and kind of tossed out on her ear. Comes back with kind of a Svengali fortune teller when all the women are married and off running their lives and puts a letter, kind of, puts the little seed for a letter to go around all the women, have them all contact this Svengali kind of fortune teller, and starts doing these seeds and starts killing them off until... And one of the more famous things in it is the woman who jumped from the Hollywoodland sign killing herself only appeared in one movie, and it is this movie.
Huh.
But I bought that because it's one of those classics, and I want to see. I want to see the classics.
Yeah.
Well, it actually was completely not even like you could only get it on VHS. Like it was gone. Like they found it tucked away somewhere.
But I mean, there's films that are long gone that I have heard of because people still talk about them. Like I would love to see London After Midnight.
Yeah.
Not ever going to happen.
Yeah.
One of the most famous lost movies ever. So far, you know what? I think Jen and I have been driving the conversation a lot. I know you've got a list, Michael.
I do have a list. And before we get completely away from foreign horror, there's one I saw last year, and it's a relatively recent film, Spanish language movie called Here Comes the Devil. And it was fantastic. I was really, really scared at various points throughout the movie, and the ending is just kind of devastating. It's one that I really want Jen to watch because it's excellent, and that I don't want her to watch because she kind of has a problem with bad things happening to children in movies. This movie is an entire one long bad things happening to children situation, but it's done with just an amazing amount of conviction and creepiness, and it was just
And I've heard a bunch fantastic. Of other people say that it's just the best thing ever, so you should watch it. So go out there and watch it if you have not the trigger problems that I do.
Yeah, I don't care about children. or adults, now that I stop thinking about it. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
So that's what you want to hear a horror author say.
Was that was out loud? Damn it. Okay, you're going to take that part
that
out,
was
right?
Yeah, sure. Right.
Sure. Okay.
Sure, Michael, yeah. I'm going to cut it out.
All right, cool. Hey. Oh, one that you should talk about is Lake Mungo.
I hadn't gotten there yet. All right. Lake Mungo is Australian. Came out 2008. Joel Anderson was director. It's very much, it's a ghost story. It's one of those sneaky movies where it's more a story about grief and how a family deals with grief. In basically in the first 6 minutes of the movie, they are, and it's kind of found footage, kind of not. So basically, a girl drowns. They're out at a beach. Kind of, it's not a ocean beach. It's a,
like, well, I would guess a lake beach, given the
lake
title.
Yeah. Lake Mungo.
Yeah. I'm thinking.
Anyhow,
I'm thinking it's a lake.
Sorry, I'm having a special moment today. Anyway, but she disappears. They hope that she just took off. They don't know where she went. They dredge the water, and they find her. Her body, but it's been in the water for a little while, and the father's the only one who has the stamina to go identify her. But they start finding out things about the daughter that were unknown. She was very secretive, and they find out about a whole hidden life that she had. And there's like two big game changers where you think you know what's going on.
You're so wrong.
And you're so wrong. And it's just heartbreaking and frightening. And then watch this movie past the credits. Do not turn the movie off.
Yeah.
During the credits. This is, it doesn't really have a scene, but there's photographs and odd things, and watch this movie all the way through, and it's just wonderful. Lake Mungo. It is, I think, an After Dark.
From the After Dark Film Festival?
Yeah. After Dark.
They put out some good stuff.
They put out some good stuff.
Yeah, some of it is, some not so good.
It's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
But anyway, but Lake Mungo. It was on my list.
Okay.
That's literally all I have for foreign.
Leaving foreign, I do want to bring up The Signal.
Yeah.
I really, really, really like The Signal. Basically, it's a movie in kind of three parts. There is a signal that goes out over, I think, radio and television, and it's kind of a zombie movie. And I actually wrote, I'm not a big romance person, and I'm not a big comedy person, so I did, I'm sorry, I'm making odd noises while I'm doing things. I did my list of my favorite romances, but then I did my favorite horror romances, and I actually included The Signal in it because it's got a vein that goes through it where kind of love leads the way. And it's just it's a really good, it's a new take on zombies. And it's, speaking of things going through the airwaves or things going through sound, I think that you need to bring up Pontypool.
Pontypool, yes. That's my big. Here's a film you probably haven't heard of that you need to watch. And it's also a kind of a zombie movie. It all takes place within a radio station. So there's this great claustrophobic feel to begin with. And so basically this zombie apocalypse is happening off screen. You know, you're getting reports from people of what's going on. And it's way more riveting than I made that sound just now. But the most interesting thing about it to me is that the vector for the zombie infection is not through bites. It's through language. Language has become infected, and you'll have to watch the film to see exactly what that means. But it was clever and original, and the central performance was pretty outstanding. Yeah, so definitely check that one out. It's a Canadian film, I believe?
Yes.
Yeah, so I guess that's technically still foreign. Them damn foreigners up in Canada, a few hundred miles north.
Do you have a couple movies that you're still waiting to talk about?
I do have a couple I want to bring up. The two I really want to bring up are cases of studio films or somewhat studio films that for some reason just kind of got lost in the shuffle, even though they're really good horror movies.
Okay.
I've got a couple of those too. So yeah, let's.
The first one I want to talk about that I just loved was Session 9.
Oh.
Yeah.
And Session 9 was just such a, and it had a cast, and David Caruso was one of the stars, and a whole bunch of other actors where you go, I recognize this actor from other things. And it used a real location, which is this old...
The Danvers Hospital?
Yeah, old mental health care hospital that just looked spooky as hell. And the premise is it's basically going to be torn down, and you've got this crew who comes in to clean out all the potentially hazardous material. Which I guess is a construction specialty.
Yeah. Asbestos.
It's the asbestos. And this crew comes in, and there's already inter turmoil with some of the crew because of stuff that's gone on with relationships. This is a great movie where you're never sure is what's going on supernatural or not.
Yeah.
I've only seen it once. I know you guys saw it twice. It has one of the best twists I've seen, and I wonder what it would be like watching it again, knowing the quick twist coming.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously I'm not.
It holds up pretty well.
Okay.
It does. And this is the weird thing is I saw it quite a while ago and really liked it, but I was somehow convinced when we were going to rewatch it that it wouldn't hold up. I don't know why I thought that, but I really strongly was like, there's no way this is as good as I remember it being, but it was. Wrong. So that was a nice surprise.
But a lot of people aren't aware of it. I think it got lost in the shuffle of a lot of other, it sounded like a found footage film. And I think people may have, even though it wasn't, I think because of that, some people brushed it aside, which is a shame. The other one that we saw recently, that it suffered from the fact that it got put on a shelf due to studio sales and various other issues, was All the Boys Love Mandy Lane. And we talked about it last time when we were talking about best films of the year in horror, but not very many people have seen this, and it's a fascinating deconstruction of the slasher genre.
I liked it. I didn't love it as much as some do. But that's because I'm not a big slasher fan. But there are things that it did so well, and it was just kind of gutting watching it. There are things that happen to people that are done that are just gutting is the only way I can think to describe it. But it's really, really worth a watch.
So those were the two big ones I really wanted to talk about. So it looks like I triggered a memory for you, though.
Yes, and now I'm trying to remember what that memory... Oh, yes. Yeah, that Jen just read my mind here. The big one is Stir of Echoes with Kevin
movie.
Bacon.
Yeah.
That movie. Yeah, that movie came out at the same time as The Sixth Sense. And everybody saw it, and then I was like, oh no, I don't want to watch another ghost movie. And I'm like, well, you should have, because it's the better film.
I love both of them, but I think it is
I don't
equally
not like
good.
The Sixth Sense, but
Stir of Echoes, is fantastic.
I thought its plot was way more interesting.
Huh? Well, okay, Stir of Echoes, you've got a movie based on a Richard Matheson story.
Always a sign of quality.
Yeah.
You know, they take one of the best authors of the genre, and from what I understand, it's one of the ones I haven't read, but my understanding is they were pretty faithful.
Yeah, and Ileana Douglas is just, I love her.
And it was something I was thinking about this week of, Kevin Bacon is a guy who had one of those careers where he was initially dismissed as another Hollywood pretty boy. Mm-hmm. Until he started going, nope, I can do serious work.
Yeah.
And again, it's like, less pretty got, better actor. Now he's well respected, and...
Yeah, this was the first thing I saw him in that made me go, wait a minute, this guy can act.
Yeah. I agree, it's a great film, especially because even though it has common elements with Sixth Sense, it's the twist, there's no huge twist of, yeah. Oh my god, he was a ghost all the time. It's a Shyamalan film, I don't care about...
Spoilers, yeah.
But in Stir of Echoes, the twist is not who's a ghost, but why did the girl die?
Yeah.
You know, the ghost in the story is a girl, and the homeowner's trying to find out why, after he's hypnotized, he gets the ability to see ghosts, which turns out to be an ability he shares with his son.
He requests to be more open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's too ambiguous a request.
Once he realizes, he's not scared of the ghost. He becomes obsessed with finding out what happened to her. He almost becomes protective of her. And I think that's what makes it so much better is he's not trying to solve the problem of why do you see ghosts. He's trying to, I've got to help her, even if it's just finding out her story.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great film.
And you have to touch on.
Oh, yeah, I will at some point. Jen just reminded me of a movie that's not as major a release, so I want to talk about one that is first. And that was Frailty, which Bill Paxton stars in, and he directed it. The setup of this is real simple, and it goes to some really bad, dark places. Is you've got this guy who's just this, you know, average working Joe, who one day comes home and tells his children that he's had a vision from God. And God has told him that... Have you seen this?
No.
Yeah, he's received this vision from God, and God has told him that they have to fight the demons. And it's going to be hard, because demons look just like regular people. But that he'll be able to tell who's really a demon because of this vision from God. Because
that could never go wrong.
Exactly. And so the younger of the two sons is like, cool! This is going to be awesome! And the older son is like,
can we talk about this?
Yeah, first? Exactly. And yeah, it just goes badly sideways in really interesting ways.
It's a movie I really want to rewatch because I think I watched it not paying enough attention. And I think it deserves a lot of attention.
Well, I haven't seen it, so that puts it open on
Let's
our
put it on the list.
Yeah. We're getting near time, so if you something else you want to...
By request, Jen wanted me to bring up Behind the Mask. The Rise of Leslie Vernon.
Another one I haven't seen.
This movie is so amazing.
It definitely leans towards comedy, but it's also pretty damn effective as a horror movie in a lot of ways as well. It's set in a world in which all horror movies are real. You know, the Jason Voorhees killings actually happened. You know, Freddy is a real thing, and our central figure, the Leslie Vernon character, is someone who desperately wants to be the next big, you know, masked serial killer.
He brings in a documentary crew
to laying out for them, okay, so this is how you set up for this, you know, here's this particular girl I'm stalking.
Here's how you train so that you can keep up with them when you're running at a brisk-paced walk.
Yeah, and it just plays with horror movie conventions, and...
It has asides to so many horror movies.
Yeah, it's clearly made by someone who loves horror movies and for some people who love horror movies.
It's been on my list of movies I've wanted to see for a long time.
We'll show it.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing it.
I know we're getting close on time, but what I just want to throw out is less specific movies and more directors that I think are not getting the attention they need. Throw out Ben Wheatley, who did Sightseers, which I saw and originally hated and can't stop thinking about, and so I'm starting to think I love it. And he also did Field in England and The Kill List. Mm-hmm. I love these movies so much. Ghost Ship, 13 Ghosts by Steve Beck, who has disappeared. I think he does commercials or something now. And I really want him to make fun horror movies because they're wonderful.
Ghost Ship has possibly the most amazing opening scene I've ever seen.
So
in a
wonderful.
Movie.
And just throw out Ty West, who is part of the Mumblegore kind of kind of set of, he did House of the Devil and The Innkeepers, mm-hmm. and is coming out with The Sacrament really soon, and his name just needs to be known. If you've watched Your Next, which is another...
Which you haven't.
Which you should, because it's wonderful, and I was kind of wondering if you were going to bring up Your Next.
Yeah, just never got around to it.
Go watch Your Next. He does a bit part in Your Next, which is just wonderful. But go see his movies.
You know, let's finish up talking about Your Next, because it was a huge release last year that for some reason just slipped through the cracks.
Because in trying to keep
the twist,
they kind of mismarketed. And you know, the thing is that killed me, and this is another one that I did a review of, that a friend at work who watches horror movies watched it and said, if you're going to watch Your Next, avoid it. It's stupid. And I'm like, well, did you get the undertones of, you know, the kind of Cabin in the Woods vein of being a movie for people who like these movies? Like, did you get the comedy of it? And he's like, no, it just seemed like another stupid slasher movie. And you just kind of have to take a little step back as you're watching it, because there's this undertone of humor. And it's so black.
I think it's pretty explicitly funny in a lot of, cases. We find it really quotable, actually.
Oh, so inappropriately quotable.
Well, and I think the beauty of Your Next is also and even though it's the central twist, it happens fairly early on of, you've got the masked creepy killers.
And they're so terrifying. Those masks are terrifying.
But then you have the subversion of the element in the house they weren't expecting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
well, the other big subversion is you're watching this and you think, oh, okay, this is just, you know, a home invasion movie. It's going to be like, help me out here. What's the big one with the baby face mask?
Oh, The Strangers.
The Strangers. Oh. It's going to be like The Strangers. They're here for no reason. But you find out, is a reason.
Yeah. They're not there because you answered the door.
And there's a really coherent plot. There's a very coherent plot. Yeah. You're next.
And it's hard to watch because the family is horrible, and you almost welcome the first kill because they stop talking to each other.
Yeah.
Because they're so horrible. It's like, it was, watching each other watch it was so uncomfortable.
That dinner scene was largely improvised.
It was horrible!
Yeah, isn't that fantastic?
And by horrible, I mean wonderful, and go watch Your Next.
So, and we really are getting ready to wrap this up, but, so here's what I'd like to ask you. And, Jen, I think you're the master of this. If somebody's looking for trying to find what the next hidden gem is, what would you recommend to do to look for or discover these great movies?
I've been seeking out a lot of podcasts. I listen to Killer POV and The Bloodcast. They're both out of LA. And just search out. Things are coming up so strangely now, where it's all word of mouth, because people aren't any inroads to making movies anymore. You can't go work for Corman and do a bunch of movies for him anymore. People are just making their own damn movies. And
I love it.
There are so many. I have a Roku player, so I obviously have Netflix, but it has Amazon. And you see those movies see it while it's in the theater. What's happening is it's getting an independent release. They are judging where to have this play in the theaters. Rent it.
Yeah.
If it looks interesting to you, buy it on video on demand. Rent it, because they might bring it to your neighborhood theater. Because a lot of these movies are getting a 13-city release.
Yeah.
And they're only going to bring it in. I mean, they are literally changing the idea of where they're going to send that movie day to day.
I'm actually reminded, this is going to, I think, be my final thought, online reviewer named Kyle Kellgren. Mm-hmm. Who does he's part of the Channel Awesome, that guy with the glasses crew.
Oh, sure.
And does a show called Brows Held High, where he mostly reviews art films. And on his Tumblr, he had opened his ask box, and the question somebody asked him was, so who do you think the big up-and-coming filmmaker is? And his answer was, who is it? All of us.
Oh.
It's us. It's the people who have loved these films, and the doorway to making something has become so blurred because of the ability to distribute things independently and online, that we are putting out so much better quality than some of the big studios because we're not adverse to risk.
Yep. Search YouTube for independent directors putting up their short films. There are so many directors now that have YouTube channels where they're making short films every couple of months, and that's where they're putting them, in hopes of getting discovered.
For me, I regularly look for the kind of lists that I was looking for this podcast. You know, look for other people's list of, you know, here's some hidden gems
you might not have seen. Here's the one you haven't seen.
And, you know, with a lot of those, like, yeah, come on, everybody's heard of that. What do you, oh, this looks interesting. You know, so... and secondly, conventions. Our local horror convention is, Crypticon. And if you go to a horror convention that has a film track, you know, that shows you, independent, unreleased films, go to that film track. You know, go watch some of these movies that people might start hearing about later.
Yeah, horror cons are, I think people don't necessarily pay attention to them because it seems, oh, it's silly. No, they're getting great people now.
Crypticon is awesome.
Yeah, I think, are you going to Crypticon this year?
I am absolutely going to Crypticon
this year. And I will be making my first visit to it.
I think I might be going with you then.
Yeah.
We'll talk because then wouldn't it be cool for us to do a post-mortem of Crypticon?
It would, yeah.
So that might be the next time you hear from all of us, although knowing us, it'll be sooner than that. Well, with that, it really is time to wrap up. This has been a fun time sitting with you guys, as always.
Yeah.
So, because this is the second of the series in this podcast, once again, how do people get in touch with you?
I can be reached at jengaloves.com or on Tumblr under Jennifer Lovely, which is my name. And you can also reach me via email at jenga@jengaloves.com, and that's J-E-N-G-A.
My main website is bloodletters.com, and that's where you can find out about my fiction. There are links to the books I have available on Amazon. The other place that I hang out most often online is also on Tumblr, and you can find me there at michaelmontour.tumblr.com.
And, of course, you can always reach me through fanboynewsnetwork.com. Leave a note in the comment section. Or I can be emailed at caliban@fanboynewsnetwork.com. So, once again, thanks to Jennifer and Michael, and thanks to all of you for listening. Take care, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Goodbye, Internet.
Bye.
This program is produced by Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network and is copyright 2014 to Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network. All rights are reserved, including rights to copy and redistribute this program. All music in this podcast comes from The Footage Firm and is used under a royalty-free license.